Open your Bibles to Mark chapter 6. Sometimes it's important to realize who you're dealing with. A private answered the phone at the National Guard Armory. The voice on the other hand said, "Can you tell me what kind of armaments you have down there at the armory?" And the private said, "Well, we've got 4 tanks, 6 Humvees, a couple of armored personnel carriers, several cases of rifles, and I don't know how many thousand rounds of ammunition." And the guy said, "Is that all you have down there?" He said, "Well, we've got a couple of Cadillacs that the big fat general rides around in." And the voice on the other end said, "Private, do you know who this is?" He says, "Well, no, I don't." He says, "This is General Felton." And the private said, "Well, General, do you know who this is?" The general said, "No." He says, "See you around, fatso." Sometimes it's important to realize who you're dealing with. Now, we've spent the last few weeks examining the stories, some of the stories of some of the people who understood who Jesus was. They came to realize who they were dealing with. Starting with those demons at Gadara. It says back in chapter 5, verse 7, that they said, What do we have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" They realized who they were dealing with. Just last week, we looked at Jairus, the synagogue ruler in Capernaum. He came and said, "Lord, if you will come and if you will touch my daughter, she'll be healed." That woman with the 12-year issue of blood realized that if I just touch the hem of his garment, there's something about him. They realized who they were dealing with. They knew who he was and they knew what he could do. And because of that, they put their faith in him. But not everybody did. And not everybody does. The lesson in these first 6 verses of Mark chapter 6 is that if you don't realize who you're dealing with in Jesus, you miss out on what he wants to do for you. Let's start reading in verse 1 of Mark chapter 6. It says, "Then he went out from there and came to his own country, and his disciples followed him. When the Sabbath had come, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many hearing him were astonished, saying, 'Where did this man get these things? And what wisdom is this which is given to him, that such mighty works are performed by his hands? Is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary, and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us?' And so they were offended at him. But Jesus said to them, 'A prophet is not without honor, except in his own country, among his own relatives, and in his own house.' Now he could do no mighty work there, except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. And he marveled because of their unbelief. And then he went about the villages in a circuit, teaching." Okay. First thing this passage shows us is that when you realize who you're dealing with in the person of Jesus Christ, you will follow him. Look at verse 1 again. He went out from there, that is, he went out from Capernaum, and he came to his own country. That would be Nazareth. Now, Capernaum is up at the north end on the, what is it, the east side of the, around the corner of the top of the Sea of Galilee, and Nazareth, you go down near the south end, not all the way, but near the south end of the Sea of Galilee, and then go west up that windy road that goes up into the hills. You'll go by Cana, where Jesus did his first miracle, turning water into wine at that wedding. And then Nazareth, the town that he was raised in. He came to his own country, and his disciples followed him. When you realize who you're dealing with, you will follow him. See, to be a disciple is to be a follower. Now, we've talked about this before, so I'll just touch briefly on this idea. A disciple is more than a learner or a pupil or a student. If you take a class at LCC, or maybe you're still in high school, you may be a student of that teacher, but you're not necessarily a disciple. They aren't the same thing. A disciple is one who's learning to be like the teacher, not just learning from the teacher. A disciple is one who is devoted to that individual and is highly concerned and motivated by the desire to have a relationship with that teacher, with that rabbi in this case, or with the master of the school. It says they followed him. His disciples followed him. This word follow is a very specific, a very unique word. There's two parts to it. The first part means to unite or join together. And the second part means on the road or along the way. So to be a disciple here, to follow as a disciple, means to be joined together with the teacher on the way. They weren't following him the way that baby ducks follow the mama duck. I mean, there's a bit of that where he goes, they go, but they aren't just following him at a distance. He's not just a trail guide showing them the way. Step here, step there. Watch out for that rock. Oop, not too close to the edge. Their whole purpose in discipleship is to develop a relationship, and they don't go behind him when they follow. They go with him. His disciples followed him on the way. They were together on the way, and that begs the question, on the way to where? Well, on the way to wherever he wants to take you. Just wherever he wants to go, that's where you go. Now, maybe that's up on the mountaintop. Maybe that's down in the valley. Mountaintops are great, aren't they? Those highlights, the peak, the pinnacle of your walk with the Lord. Remember, Peter had a mountaintop experience, literally. He and James and John were invited to follow Jesus to the top of the Mount of Transfiguration. And it says he was transfigured. He went from his normal, human, everyday Jesus. Suddenly he began to shine, to glow. A pure, bright light emanated from him. And there was Moses. And there was Elijah. And they were talking. Jesus was talking with them, and then the voice of the Father said, "This is my Son. You know, listen to him." Now, Peter was literally and figuratively on the mountaintop. He said, "Lord, let's put up some tents. You know, let's just make this our camp. Let's stay here. In fact, let's don't ever leave. You just keep shining. And tell Moses and Elijah, we'll build them a tent too, and they can hang around." You know, that mountaintop experience is something that you never want to leave. And sometimes the Lord will lead you as you follow him as his disciple to a mountaintop experience. Other times, unfortunately, we follow him into those valleys. The night before he was crucified, Peter said, "I will fight. I will go with you to the grave. I'll never deny you. You can, these other flakes might disappear, Lord, but I will stand next to you." And Jesus said, "You know what, Peter? Before the rooster crows, you're going to deny me three times. Never. It'll never happen." Well, guess what? Fast forward to the next morning, and there Peter is warming himself by the fire, and the rooster crows. And Jesus walks out beaten and bloodied, and they lock eyes. And Peter just says, "That's it. I guess I blew it. I'm going to go back home. I'm going to go fishing. Not in a good way. I give up. Talk about down in the valley. We all have those mountaintop as well as those down in the valley experiences. But here's the thing. See, it's not the destination that concerns the Lord. It's the journey. It's the walking with Him along the way. What do you do when you're taking a walk with somebody? You talk, tell stories, you share things. If it's a long walk or if it's a good friend, you share things that you might not share if you're in a bunch of strangers or a bunch of rowdy folks just kind of out for a party. But when you're walking with somebody day by day and you get to know them and they get to know you, and that discipleship, that disciple-teacher relationship begins to develop, and you learn and you share. And whether you're going up to the mountaintop or down in the valley isn't really the point. It's the journey. You know, I got to say that too often I find myself going my own way rather than following the Lord, rather than, you know, being a disciple, walking along the way with Him. I find myself kind of taken off on a side trail. I'll be right back, Lord. You know, excuse me for a minute. You know, and sometimes that, well, not sometimes, all the times, it seems like I get into trouble. Sometimes it's just little things, though, you know. I'm not talking about walking away from the Lord or abandoning your faith. I'm talking about little things for me. It's like, you know, what I do with my time. Because the Lord's got some place He's taken me. And again, it's the journey, not the destination that matters. It's the walking with Him. Like Adam did in the cool, you know, in the garden in the cool of the day. Just that relationship time. But I go my own way. Sometimes just little things like what I do with my time. You know, I think I'd like to strangle the guy who invented television. The time in my life, I look back, you know, because when, you know, TV was a brand new babysitter when I was young, and they just park us kids in front of it, and we'd watch, you know, Paladin or The Lone Ranger or Sea Hunt or, you know, one of those shows. Pete and Gladys, I always liked that one. Hazel, that was a good one. We used to watch that all the time. You know, I noticed one thing, or I didn't notice it for years, but you ever notice when you're watching TV that the people on TV don't watch TV? See, they have lives. You're sitting there. Now, if they were watching TV, they'd be sitting there looking at you going. But they don't. They have lives. And it's, you know, and all the things that we learn from watching television, I mean, the stupid songs that are in my head, I wish I could get rid of. Meet George Jetson. You know. But they're cousins. I'll be there for you. Flintstones, meet the Flintstones. You know, it's just like if I had a scripture verse for every one of those dumb songs. Johnny Yuma was a rebel. It's like, you don't even know you know these things. And all of a sudden they start coming up, you know. just the way I spend my time, and I'm not talking about, you know, just now, but I look back over my life and all the time when I could have been walking with the Lord, I could have been following Him. Or forget the whole life. How about just the last 20 years since the Lord sort of drew me to Himself? Even though I consider myself a committed student, a devoted disciple, you know, even so, I think of the different ways I've frittered away my time. It's just those little things, you know. But then also sometimes it's big things, like what I do with my life, the decisions I make. I could be walking with the Lord. I could be following Him. I could be going deeper and deeper into that master-disciple relationship. But instead, I make these bad decisions. It's the dumbest thing I've ever done. And I know I've shared this before. In 1997, I decided, I convinced myself that the Lord was calling me out of the ministry I was in. Now, you know, I knew the Lord called me to the ministry. I don't remember any verse about the Lord calling anyone out. of a ministry. In fact, I'm pretty sure it says just the opposite. There's something about the Lord being without repentance in these things. But I convinced myself, oh, I'm sure it's of the Lord, and I'll just turn the thing over to this guy, and I'll go down here and do this thing and see what the Lord has for me, and you know. Wrong. Mistake. Bad decision. I wasn't following the Lord at all. And it's taken, that was 9 years ago, and sometimes I feel like I'm just now catching up to where I left off before I made that decision. Now, the Lord's taught me a lot of great things along the way. And although I regret the bad decision, I don't regret where that process has led me. Don't get the wrong idea, but you know, I could have been walking with the Lord. If I had just kept following Him, if I had only realized and remembered who I was dealing with and trusted Him all through that process. If you're, or when you realize who you're dealing with, you follow Him. That's what disciples do. Not only that, you also follow His example. Look at verse 2. It says, when the Sabbath had come, He began to teach in the synagogue. See, even though Jesus was doing a brand new thing in a brand new way, He honored and worked within the existing system. He waited till the Sabbath and started teaching in the synagogue. If Jesus had been a little less God-centered, if He had had a little shorter fuse, He might have just marched into Nazareth, and you know, on a Thursday night at midnight, instead of waiting for the Sabbath in the synagogue, and gone on the corner and said, "Hey, everybody, gather around, get up, wake the kids, come on down. All that old stuff with the synagogue and the temple, that's all over now. I've got a new thing I want to share with you." And they would have been looking, where's a rock? Where's a stick? Where's something we're going to get this guy? He didn't do that. Now, He had a new thing. He had a brand new way of doing things and a new way of relating to God. That was His mission. But He honored and worked within the old system. He waited till the Sabbath. And He started in the synagogue. See, we got to realize, it's important to remember that the synagogue wasn't just the building where you turned the lights on once a week and folks gathered together. The synagogue was the center of life. Wherever there were 10 or more adult Jewish males, there was a synagogue. And Nazareth certainly surpassed that minimum requirement. So the synagogue was it was everything formerly. It was the school where the kids went every day. It was the community center. It was the spiritual center. It was where the gals went scrapbooking. You know, and where the guys got, where the Bible studies happened. It was kind of the equivalent of Drew's Market. You know, it's where everybody meets. I stopped in at Drew's Friday night on the way to dinner to pick up some ice, and I'm standing out in the, out in the parking lot, and there's Chuck drives up. Hey, Chuck, how's it going? And we're talking. Oh, you going to come to the men's breakfast? You going to come to the concert? Oh yeah. And then I walk over, and there's somebody else. And it's like, you know, I can just, who needs email? You just go down to Drew's and kind of wait. Everybody will show up. And you tell them in person. Well, that was the synagogue. Everybody, if it wasn't literally in the center of town, it was in every other way. It was the center of life. And so Jesus waits until the Sabbath, the prescribed time, the traditional time, goes to the synagogue, the traditional place, to announce what He's doing. He had this mission, no doubt about it. He had a calling from God, but in accomplishing that calling and accomplishing that mission, He honored and worked within the existing system. And that's an example that we need to follow. How many times do we try to reinvent the ministry wheel? I mean, I know it's been done before, but I've got a new idea. I've got a better idea. You know what "I've got a better idea" really means? It means I want to do it my way. That's all that means. Now, that might have worked for Frank Sinatra, although, look, it didn't exactly turn out too great for him, did it? They buried him with a pack of Camels and a bottle of Jack Daniels. Is that, I mean, this is kind of beside the point, but is that really the ultimate celebration of a life well lived? You know, a nicotine delivery system and an alcohol, if that's what his loved ones think his life amounted to. He did it his way, all right. And that's what we set out to do far too often when it comes to ministry. We just want to do things our way. You know the old saying, there are three ways to do everything. The right way, the wrong way, and my way. And too often we choose my way instead of the Lord's way. That's really the problem. For us, ministry starts here. You get an idea. I'd like to learn the Word. I'd like to really invest myself, and I want to just carry my Bible around, and I don't want to just read it once in a while. And Bible study is good, but man, I want to know this Word. I want this Word to get into me so that when the world squeezes me, it's God's Word that comes out. Well, that's a great goal. I encourage you in that. But you don't need to move to Outer Mongolia and go to somebody's Bible college to do that. Now, if the Lord's calling you to go, go by all means. But don't think that that's necessary. You don't need to go anywhere for that kind of thing. If you want to learn the Word, you can start at Bible study. Right here. Come on Wednesday nights. Join a home group. You know what we're doing right here on Sundays? We've gone through Ephesians and 1 Corinthians, and now we're in Mark. And we go verse by verse, sometimes word by word. And we'll be going at it till the Lord comes. And we may or may not cover the whole book, depends on his timing, but that's what we're doing here. You don't need to go somewhere else or have some new idea. You want to learn? Go to Bible study. You want to teach? Then lead a Bible study. It's pretty simple. You want to help the homeless? Start here. Go down by the river or under the bridge, or you want to help people, that need some with the food and people that are having a hard time. You got a burden for a ministry for single moms and dads. Hey, there are plenty of them up and down the highway. Just do it here. You want to mentor young girls that are struggling? Hey, come see me. I'll give you half a dozen names and numbers today. Just do it. You don't have to go somewhere else. You can work within what God's already doing. Again, it reminds me of what Henry Blackaby said. What we usually do is get a bright idea, and it's really our idea. It's going to be Ron Stevens International Ministries Incorporated with a big picture of me on the sign. But it's not about me. It's really about the Lord. That's why my face and my name are all over it, and my business cards say executive apostle, You don't have to call me or email me, just and I'll pick it up. And then we say, Lord, bless this thing I'm doing. I want to do this and I want to do that and I want to minister here and I want to minister there and I want to meet these needs and bless these people. So Lord, if you're not too busy, if you have a minute, just get behind this thing and make it go. And Blackaby makes a great point. He says, how about this? Why don't you just look around right where you are, see what God's already doing, and get in on that. How about that? That's what Jesus did. He didn't come in there. He had a new thing. He had a new approach, salvation by faith, not salvation by the works of the law. But he came in and he started in that existing system. He honored it, he respected it, and he used it to accomplish God's will. The thing is about going out into Timbuktu to do ministry is that the satisfaction of serving the Lord is the same right here at home. In fact, maybe it's even better. If you realize who you're dealing with, you're going to want to follow him. You're going to want to follow his example. And lastly, when you realize who Jesus is, you are going to put your faith in him. Verse 2, near the end of the verse, he takes off again here. Many hearing him were astonished, saying, where did this man get these things? What wisdom is this which is given to him that such mighty works are performed by his hands? How does he get this? Where did he come from? Or we know where he came from. That's why it's so hard to get. He's at home. He's in his hometown. Isn't that this is the little boy I used to say, you kids go play somewhere else. You're making too much noise. Get that ball out of here. Take that goat. You know, you can't hang out in front of my house. And we know him. He grew up here. Where did he get all this knowledge? Where did he get this power? How did he become this person that he is? Verse 3, isn't this the carpenter's son? The carpenter, the son of Mary? And, you know, are they here, his brothers, and aren't his sisters all around us? And it says they were offended at him. And so Jesus said, you know, a prophet is not without honor. I mean, you know, everywhere I go, a prophet is honored and appreciated, except not in his own country, not among his own relatives and his own house. Then you're just, you know, Jimmy. And he couldn't do any mighty works there, except that he laid hands on a few. We'll come back to that in a minute. Here's a warning. This passage, these verses are a warning if you look at it just right. Do not let your preconceptions about who Jesus is trip you up. See, that's what happened to these folks. Make sure that who you think he is who he really is. Don't let your preconceptions get in the way. In verse 3, they say, and near the end of the verse, isn't this the son of Mary, you know, the carpenter son of Mary? Interesting, they don't note Joseph, the understanding is, the theory is that by this point in time, Joseph is dead, is no longer there. So he's identified as a carpenter. Interesting, this word carpenter, it doesn't mean master furniture builder, you know, or house home builder. It means handyman. It's the guy you call when your garbage disposal plugged up. You know, it's not a title of esteem, the carpenter. It's translated carpenter. But really, it just means kind of that shady fly-by-night kind of fix-it. You know, I'll charge you $300 to put that one brick back on your chimney with those guys that go around like that. That's the kind of deal. This is the carpenter, the son of Mary. We know him. We know his brothers. They name their names. We know his sisters. See, that's who they thought he was. That's the way they'd always known him. But that's not who he really is. Who he really is, not the son of Mary. He's the son of God. That's who he's shown himself to be. And that tripped him up. He's the son of God. He's the creator. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. He's the agent of creation. He's the Savior. He's the living Word. Hebrews calls him the author and finisher of our faith. Another way to translate that is trailblazer. He went first with the machete and hacked all the brush out of the way so that then he could say, okay, everybody, come on. This deal, this salvation by faith, because of God's grace, you know, he blazed the trail, the author and the finisher. He started it, he finished it. That's who he really is. He's not who they thought he was, and they tripped over that. It says near the, at the end of verse 3? They were offended at him. That word offended, could better be translated scandalized. Scandalizo or something like that in Greek. You know, he was a scandal to them. Now that's hard for us to get a handle on. You know, hardly, there's no such thing as a scandal anymore. There's not. When's the last time you read or heard or saw something that someone had done and you just went, oh, I'm undone. I can't believe it. That just can't be happening. That's just, you can't hurt us anymore. We got presidents romping around in the, whatever you call it, the Oval Office with girls and you know, the last however many years, and gosh, the more you learn about John Kennedy, the less you respect him. And you know, and the news today, and you've got what's his name, who's, you know, young assistant disappeared. She just kind of disappeared, and then there was a war that took the attention off of him. He kind of dodged a bullet there. But you know, are your next door neighbors? I remember our two houses down from us. I was 8 years old, and I heard my parents speaking in hushed tones in their bedroom with the door closed. And it took me, like, I was 12 years old before I found out what, that the girl, two houses down, 16-year-old girl had turned up pregnant. Now, not that she was a scandal or that she was wicked or evil, but just that such a thing would happen in that day and age was just unthinkable. And it was kind of, you just kind of went into shock. Oh, I can't believe it. Now it's like, oh, well, so-and-so's pregnant. Oh, really? You know, well, what's on TV tonight? What's for dinner? There's no such thing as a scandal. You can't shock us. We've seen it all. We've been there and done that. We've seen too much. But these folks were absolutely scandalized that this boy that grew up in their town was now coming in and was supposed to be the healer and the Messiah, the Savior, the Son of God. It was just a scandal. They were absolutely offended. It was the tension between who they thought he was and who he really is that they just couldn't reconcile in their thinking. In fact, turn to Romans chapter 9. Just turn up a few pages or a little bit. Because this is, God predicted, you know, hundreds of years before that this would exactly be the case, that these people would be tripped up on who Jesus really is. Romans chapter 9, starting in verse 30, writes, "What shall we say then? That Gentiles, that is, non-Jews, who didn't pursue righteousness have attained to righteousness, even the righteousness of faith. That is, that the Gentiles, you know, who didn't follow the law have received God's righteousness through faith. But Israel, you know, God's chosen people, pursuing the law of righteousness, has not attained to the law of righteousness. Why? Because they didn't seek it by faith, but as it were by the works of the law, for they stumbled at that stumbling stone, as it is written, 'Behold, I lay in Zion a stumbling stone and rock of offense, and whoever believes on him will not be put to shame.'" See, their very reaction to Jesus is just another, log on the fire that proves he is who he says he is and that his people believe him to be. He's that stumbling stone to be expected. They just couldn't reconcile. See, when you realize who you're dealing with, you put your faith in him. You can either trip over him or you can build your life on him. Those are the only options he's left us. Verse 5. It says, "Now he could do no mighty work there, except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them." He says that so sort of nonchalant. I couldn't do much. Laid hands on a few people and healed them. If I ever lay hands on one person and heal them, you'll hear about it. I'll write my own book. It'll be a big deal. Well, he couldn't heal too many, you know. I mean, after, I guess, based on his track record, this really was kind of a fizzle, you know, in the whole thing. But he couldn't do much. Why couldn't he do much? Here's why. Lack of belief limits what you can receive from the Lord. Lack of faith, lack of belief limits what you receive from the Lord. See, just like Jairus, we talked about last week, and that woman with the issue of blood for 12 years, remember that it was their faith that made them well. And it's the same with us. It's your faith that makes the difference. This woman, she got what she believed. She got what she trusted the Lord for, and he didn't even see her coming. Jairus got more than he asked for, more than he expected. Got his daughter back from death because he believed Jesus. And so then you have to ask, what are you believing? What are you believing not in as much as for? What are you trusting the Lord for? Well, I know I'll go to heaven when I die, but my marriage is just beyond hope. Well, I know that the Lord has forgiven me for the things that sent me to jail, but I'll never get a job with a felony conviction on my record. Oh, ye of little faith, do you realize who you're dealing with here? See, if that's what you believe, then that's what you'll get. You got to realize who you're dealing with here. Jesus died to take away the sin that separates you from God. Problem solved. Then he rose from death, from the grave, in order to give you a brand new life, a brand new kind of life, where he actually lives in you and through you. So you're thinking, well, my sins are forgiven, but how am I ever going to do this? You're not. He doesn't ask you to or expect you to. Paul says, the life I now live, it's Christ in me. That's what Jesus has done. That's who we're dealing with. And do you really think that finding you a job is too hard for him? What do you believe in him for? Verse 6 says he marveled because of their unbelief. Check this out. There are two occasions recorded in the New Testament where Jesus marveled at anything. The first one is in Matthew, I think it's chapter 8, where he marvels at the faith of the centurion. Remember that story? A Roman, a Gentile, not even a Jew, says, Lord, my servant is sick and he needs to be healed. And Jesus says, okay, I'll go. And the guy goes, oh, well, no, you don't even need to come to my house. You just say it. Just say it. Just, you know, think it. Just do it. And I know he'll be healed. And Jesus says, he marveled. I haven't seen such faith even in all of Israel. Here's this Gentile, this Roman, this foreigner, this military official, and Jesus says, even among all of God's people, from the high priest on down, I've never seen faith like this, and he marveled at it. That's number one. Number two is right here. He marveled at their lack of faith. They didn't get it. They didn't realize who they were dealing with. They thought he was just a guy, maybe a good teacher. Maybe kind, maybe all kinds of maybes, but they didn't get who he was. They didn't realize who they were dealing with. We tend to forget who we're dealing with. We get so comfortable, so familiar. We show up at 10:01, sing a song, pass the plate, say a prayer, then it's back to real life. That's not real life. That other life, that's not real life. That's not real life at all. See, the same Lord that gave his life for you gives real life to you when you trust him, when you put your faith in him. And that same thrill that you experienced when God's amazing grace first touched your life can be yours all day, every day. All day, when you just realize and remember who you're dealing with. See, you're dealing with Jesus. And he's dealing with you right now.